Hello and welcome back once again to Principles of Environmental Toxicology. Well, in today's lecture, we're going to do the second in a series of four case study lectures on environmental chemicals. Today's lecture, what we'll do is continue our discussion of inorganic toxicants in the environment and focus on several of them. We'll use these case studies actually to learn and go in depth a little bit more on some toxicants, in particular cyanide, looking at a particular release incident in an aquatic ecosystem and learning a little bit more about cyanide toxicity. And as well, we'll introduce, I guess, for the first time in depth and detail here in Principles of Environmental Toxicology, the concepts of radionuclides as toxicants. And we'll use this to explore some mishaps, such as Chernobyl and Three Mile Island in our environmental history, as well as some of the challenges, the future challenges in terms of managing what is referred to as mixed waste. What happens, especially historically, in the run-up to World War II, with all of the nuclear weapons manufacturing operations, when you had not only these extraordinarily hazardous radionuclides, but you also had the typical contaminants such as solvents and heavy metals that were associated with manufacturing operations. For today's lecture, our learning objectives, we'd like to have you be able to examine the cause and effects of the release of an industrial cyanide heavy metals impoundment in a major European river system. This is, and another case study in Spain, are going to discuss chemicals that are stored and managed on large-scale mining and milling operations and what happens when things go bad. We're going to have as well you examine the heavy metals release from a tailings dam failure in southwestern Spain. All of these happened, I think, in the past 6 or so years. We're going to have you be able to describe the science and some of the toxicological impacts of ionizing radiation resulting from radionuclides. And so in a certain sense, this is our introduction to radionuclides, radiochemistry, if you will, radioenvironmental chemistry, and the relative risk of all of the potential radionuclides that are released by various nuclear processes that we use in industries such as electrical power generation, and also resulting from the manufacture of weapons using nuclear ingredients. Would like you also to be able to understand the science and some of the issues around what is again referred to as mixed waste management, and this is a U.S. focus. We have dozens, if not hundreds, of DOE and DOD sites that have some level of mixed waste management concern. We'll talk about the scope. It's a multi-billion dollar opportunity for the future in terms of making things better for some of those that are employed in government service and contracting and in engineering, trying to come up with some of the solutions to some of these tremendous challenges. We'll then also finish up, and we'll do a video as well, examining some of the technological difficulties associated with managing these radionuclides, especially when they migrate into the subsurface. For a long time, we thought that burying it and pouring it on the soil was a way to get rid of all sorts of waste materials. We now find with things that have half-lives of hundreds, if not thousands of years, this was probably the worst-case scenario, especially where there is a potential for impact to groundwater or a resurfacing down gradient, down the hydraulic gradient. We'll focus on the Hanford Reservation. This is about 200 miles or so west of our university, and how the subsurface plumes from storage tanks there are migrating towards the Columbia River, Columbia River being a major aquatic ecosystem in the northwestern Pacific Northwest of the United States. Well, our first case study is in Romania. This is Baia Mare. This happened in January 2000, so this is relatively recent history. So big problematic environmental incidents are a part of our most recent environmental history, as well as the environmental history of decades ago. This particular case study details a cyanide leak from a gold smelter operation that polluted a major European river system. mining operations for gold use cyanide in heap leach extraction processes, and the residual cyanide is stored with the heavy metals, the slurries, and some of the milling tailings behind dams. These are large, quite often acid rock drainage containing solutions. In this particular case, the break in a tailings dam, this is a 25 meter break, this is an artificial man-made dam, behind it many gallons of waste. In this particular release there was 100,000 cubic meters of waste, not only as the slurry but also as the dissolved substrates in the water that were released into the Tisa and the Danube river system. The Danube is Europe's largest waterway. This particular accident wiped out fish stocks and threatened water supplies in several of the countries downstream from the spill. And this is a pretty significant toxicant, cyanide, as you probably understand at this point in time in your principles of environmental toxicology training, is an acute toxicant, and therefore has the ability to have very acute lethality, especially in an aquatic ecosystem release such as this one. Give you some geospatial information. Baia Mare is up in the Carthinian Mountains here in eastern Romania. You can see that it is near these river systems as you flow down gradient. Here's the Tisa and the junction of the Tisa into the Danube around Belgrade. This is a fairly major operation. This particular map comes from around 2000. It still has Yugoslavia, and the data that we'll present today still refer to the former Republic of Yugoslavia, although we know that in 2003 it was divided into Croatia and Serbia, Montenegro. The background of this particular release was that there was a particularly heavy snowfall that winter. It caused an overflow of the tailings dam. As the overflow, these tailings dams sometimes are just earthen dams, rock and earth packed in. They typically are engineered, but in this particular case, obviously, it was not engineered sufficiently. This wastewater containing the cyanide from the processing of the gold operation leaked into the adjacent Lapis River and then entered the Somas River and then crossed the boundary into Hungary before reaching the Tisa River. What you can see right here, especially with Europe and Central European nations, many countries packed together in a relatively small area, the ability to have transnational contamination from incidents like this is quite high. In this particular case, I think there was probably at least a half a dozen countries involved as this contaminant plume moved down this aquatic ecosystem. The waste material was 100,000 cubic meters of liquid waste. It entered the water with about 7,800 milligrams per liter cyanide concentration. This is particularly significant. This is essentially 0.8% cyanide solution. In terms of aquatic impacts and potential for aquatic toxicity, you'd need to dilute this significantly to not see, to have a no effect level on the aquatic ecosystem. This came from the neighboring country in Hungary. This is a conservative estimate, but the release in terms of tonnage of cyanide was about 100 tons of material. Now, in terms of fish and its acute, chronic, and sublethal toxicity, this is a good figure here in terms of charting out the lethal effects and the sublethal effects associated with cyanide. Cyanide can bind the iron on various enzymes, cytochrome type enzymes, as well as hemoglobin in terms of interfering with oxygen transport at the organismal and as well the cellular basis. Lethal effects, the acute concentration, this is LC50 for 96 hour wet test acute toxicity. The acute concentration is on the order of 50 to 200, this would be micrograms per liter, or 0.5 to 0.2 milligrams per liter total cyanide. for chronic exposure in terms of chronic exposure leading to lethality. We have concentrations of 0.002 to 0.07 milligrams per liter. Again, quite low concentrations leading to lethality, especially compared to the 7,800 milligrams per liter in terms of the parent waste material. In terms of sublethal effects on fish, this chart gives the activity or organ that's affected on this side, and then the nature of the effect at these particular concentrations. The concentrations, for example, inhibiting spawning and egg production are on the order of 5 to 10 parts per billion. Egg viability is reduced by almost half at 0.065 parts per million. Infertile eggs and spermatogenesis abnormal, again, in the low parts per billion range. Embryonic development, hatching, swimming, deformities, all of these, again, in the subpart per million type concentrations. And so not only do we have the potential for acute lethality and chronic lethality, we have some sublethal effects here in terms of reproductive and developmental toxicity, all being significant in terms of survival of the species in some of these pop ecosystem areas. In terms of the scope of contamination, this chart gives you essentially a timeline, and we'll look at a graphic here in a moment. But as the people in the neighboring communities and countries were alerted of this, there was an initial order to monitor, obviously, in terms of safety from drinking water or consumption of wildlife, especially fish, from the contaminated ecosystem. In a spring in Romania, the cyanide was testing at 800 times higher than the allowed concentration. As you go down in the date, and here's February 1st, 2000 at the top of the graph, and this is about 2 weeks later, February 13th, you can see that as we're going down in the location, down gradient in the rivers and streams, you can see that the concentration is generally decreasing. The concentration in Hungary was still 32 parts per million, significantly over the lethal, acute lethal impact levels. The other thing that was released, by the way, is also the heavy metal consortia associated with the mining operation, significant quantities of lead at 540 micrograms per liter and copper at 12,000 micrograms per liter, significantly high heavy metal content as well. What you can see as you go down this list, and you can look at the slide yourself, is that at 2 weeks later, we were almost still at concentrations approaching a half a part per million to a part per million, sufficient for some acute and chronic lethality in aquatic species. This graphic gives you a little bit of better array of that same data. It's fairly interesting. This is the day from the zero time of the incident. So here's time zero at this end, and this is 2 weeks later. And these stacked graphs are the direction of flow. And so these are monitoring stations down gradient in the affected aquatic ecosystem. In this axis, this is the milligrams per liter of cyanide concentration, starting off here at zero and up at this axis at 14 parts per million. You can see that early on in the incident, we had significant double-digit part per million concentrations for quite some time. It took about a week or so for those to start coming down into single digits, but you can see that there was relatively good conservation of dose as you went down in this aquatic ecosystem, that we are still bordering on 1 to 2 parts per million, 2 to 4 parts per million for a significant amount of time. So what this was demonstrating, and if you can look at, for example, this one green graph right here in the middle, that this is typical plug flow, that the contamination plug came into this monitoring station, it reached its maxima and then decreased over time. And so this was a very large plug of contaminated water. And if you look at the base of each one of these peaks, you can see that this high concentration, especially if we take mean width half maximum, we take an average here, that average relatively high concentration exceeding a part per million lasted for several days. This is a significant in terms of the timing and the dosage allowed to these particular aquatic ecosystems. This is a formula for sure kill because none of the inhabitants could escape the potential advection and dispersion of the contaminant as it came down this fairly large aquatic ecosystem. The polluted waters move downstream to the Danube, and that forms Romania's border with Bulgaria for over 500 miles. Various countries along this impacted waterway banned water intake in the Danube and fishing in the Danube as it moved down towards the Black Sea. Of concern to wildlife ecologists was the fact that the Black Sea Delta, like many estuarine ecosystems, is a very biologically productive area. A lot of nesting and spawning activity happening in the delta. This had a dramatic impact in terms of wildlife populations and communities. The spill eradicated life in the water. Cyanide is a very potent acute toxin at these concentrations. There's about 250 miles of river that, in terms of major life forms, was effectively sterilized. It killed thousands of fish in Hungary and in the former Yugoslav Republic. These figures show some of the cleanup operations in terms of trying to get the abandoned, killed populations out of the water, the idea to prevent secondary toxicosis to any sort of predators or carnivores that might feed on these carcasses. This shows you a little bit about the terrestrial mortality. Many species of animals use aquatic ecosystems, whether for cover or for food chain effects, whether it be livestock or avian species. This is a particularly acute lethality. Birds that were feeding on the fish in this particular ecosystem or the plant life were exposed to high concentrations of cyanide. It was obviously great public health concern when you've got a substantial water body like the Danube, where you've got an incredible toxic plume coming down, toxic enough that it would be lethal even to higher mammals. You saw the mule in the previous slide. This caused a tremendous outrage in terms of public health, environmental quality, concern about the management of some of these industrial operations in other countries, a lot of international concern as well, essentially the operations and the environmental law and the industrial development in one country contaminated the ecosystems of several surrounding countries, and this can cause tremendous international tensions. Our next case study was Enzacollar, Spain, and this happened in April 25th, 1998, again in our recent environmental history. I decided to use this one because it too was a tailings dam failure, and so this kind of talks about some of these mining challenges. It continues our discussion of some of the challenges of these large operations. Again, mining are large, messy operations. It requires a lot of production of ore and some of the waste products of ore. It's a tremendously difficult job to be able to do in a way that minimizes impact to the environment, and quite often these activities to minimize the impact are costly, and so it is perhaps a challenge for some countries and some companies to stay in business and still do mining. What happens when we have poor engineering of tailings dams, as in this particular case, you can see that the dramatic impacts, that the cost of failure far outweighs the cost of maintaining and engineering robust solutions to the challenge of these mining impacted environments. What happened here in Enzacollar was that there was a dam failure at the Los Frailes lead zinc mine in Enzacollar, and this is near Seville, Spain. This is not far from the coast. It released 4 to 5 million cubic meters of tailings slurries. And again, tailings being this powdery material that is wasted after the extraction of the mineral concentrates during the flotation process in milling operations for mining. It released into the Rio Grio and then into the Rio Guadiamar. This slurry wave of materials, obviously with acid rock drainage, high heavy metals, it covered 5,000 hectares of farmlands, including parts of the Doñana protected area. This is one of the largest protected areas in the EU, and it was a World Heritage Site. Here's a situation where the slurry covered not only was released into aquatic ecosystems, but also spilled off into low-lying flatlands as well. Give you an idea of where we're at. So we're just outside of Seville. We're actually not too far from the coast in terms of where the water gradient is flowing. This gives you an idea of some of the pictures of this, and I have the AP feed. This is an AP photograph in this particular thing. You can see the size of the tailings dam break here. So behind here, this is the tailings impoundment. You can see the layers of slurry. This would appear to be usually dark-colored, sulfur-smelling sand, quite often, usually heavy metal concentrations in the low percents, so 1, 2, 3%, usually high iron. You can see some iron staining here. What happens when you have a tailings dam here, and so it's impounded behind this engineered dam, is that you get some deposition of the sand materials, the tailings materials at the bottom, and there's water on the top. The water is typically acidic. In terms of reading the AP feed, an aerial view of the dike of a mine reservoir outside the southern Spanish city of Seville, Monday, April 27, 1998, after it burst, dumping an estimated 5 million cubic meters of toxic waste into the Guadiamar River. Hastily constructed dikes diverted the toxic liquid away from Doñana Park, one of Europe's most prized natural preserves, and towards the Guadiacavar River, which flows into the Atlantic Ocean 37 miles downstream. This gives you an idea of what a slurry of this material looks like, and these are reduced sulfide-containing substrates in part of this, and you can kind of see that there is a potential impact of what look like agricultural lands. To read the AP feed, a black stain of toxic mud coming from a broken dike in a mine reservoir covers the countryside near Enza Cuellar in southern Spain. This is another image, again, showing you the break in the dam containing the tailings from this gold mining operation. This particular gold mining operation was managed by an international consortium by an Australian firm, led by an Australian firm. This shows you the impacted farmland. Again, the tailings spill off into, in this particular case, orchards. The farmer here dumping some of the contaminated vegetables from this particular incident. There was impacted aquatic habitat. About 60 kilometers of the Guadiamar principal riverbed was absolutely destroyed, according to one of the researchers, the ecologists working on this particular site. So this did have dramatic aquatic ecosystem impacts. It contaminated agricultural areas. Remember that if we have heavy metals that are depositing in agricultural soils, there is a potential for impact beyond the initial contamination because of root processes over time. We're going to switch now to our final area of case studies, and this is ionizing radiation. We'll talk about several incidents of environmental contamination with radionuclides. But before we get to that, we'd like to be able to just introduce and go back and provide a foundation for you on radionuclides and the ionizing radiation they can produce. Now, we can define ionizing radiation, and this is X-rays and alpha particles, and they can cause chemical reactions and alterations of chemicals in tissues. This is associated with radionuclide poisoning, and ionizing radiation is the worst kind, or the strongest kind of radionuclide emissions. They can be toxic or fatal. Much of the reactivity within organisms actually starts with the reaction of these high energy waves or particles with the water molecule itself. When we do have this ionizing radiation impacting water, we can produce superoxide radical, we can produce hydroxyl radical, hydroperoxy radicals, and hydrogen peroxide. This should give you at least pause to reflect back on our lecture discussions of oxidative stress. There are other processes, chemical processes, that also produce these highly potent oxidants. And so our antioxidant processes that compensate for our respiratory oxidation are the same ones that can manage ionizing radiation. Typically what happens, though, is that these radionuclides produce such a level of oxidation that it exceeds the capacity of the organism to repair itself, and essentially the oxidants damage sufficient amount of cell walls, releasing some of the contents of the cells, and there is tissue damage at multiple levels. If we recall the endpoints of oxidative stress, remember lipid peroxidation, DNA strand breaks, enzyme inactivation, covalent binding to nucleic acids and also to proteins, all of these can be the endpoints of ionizing radiation as well. We can also have direct ionization of various organic molecules in the biological system, and these can yield very reactive carbonium ions. These carbonium ions have a nasty habit of alkylating DNA. Alkylated DNA is mutated DNA, and so ionizing radiation is a mutagen. One of the examples in terms of our own exposure to ionizing radiation, and there is a normal natural background of ionizing radiation, whether it be from cosmic rays that come to us from space, or from ionizing radiation in background materials in the Earth. One of these is radon. Radon is a byproduct of naturally occurring minerals, typically granitic minerals. It's a noble gas. It emits alpha particles, and so it thus is ionizing radiation. The problem with radon gas is when we build houses, especially houses that have basements in granitic areas, there is a possibility that radon as a gas can accumulate in these spaces and present significant risk to the people living in that house. You may have seen radon test kits in your local hardware store. These are especially popular in areas where there are mineral formations in the subsurface that have the potential to yield radon gas. In terms of our exposure, the health physicists that do the calculations in terms of exposure to various typical levels of ionizing radiation, background levels, cosmic rays, the number of airplane flights, chest x-rays that we get, they calculate in terms of our risk, and typically when we deal with risk associated with ionizing radiation, we talk about risks of increased cancer rates, that the major risk in terms of the American population from ionizing radiation is actually from this potential for accumulated radon gas in basements. Now, radiation sickness is a term that you may have heard, and this is typically associated with, again, an overload of our systems. I always like to think of radiation sickness as what happens when we have these microscopic machine guns spitting out these high energy particles that have the ability to ionize the chemicals around them. Radiation sickness is the general term for the illness that is caused by the effects of radiation on body tissues, and it's a multi-symptomatic process. It can be acute, it can be delayed, or it can be chronic. It may occur as the result of cumulative exposure to various small doses of radiation It could also be from the exposure to solar radiation. So when you get a second degree sunburn, this is a form of radiation sickness. This is the ultraviolet burning the cells and causing destruction of the dermal layer on your skin. The symptoms of radiation sickness may be mild and transitory, or they can be severe depending upon dose and the type of radiation and the rate at which the exposure was experienced. Some of the symptoms of radiation sickness can be weakness, loss of appetite, vomiting, diarrhea, a tendency to bleed, and this is has to do with the perforations of our vascular system from these oxidants. Increased susceptibility to infection because of damage to the immune cells, and in severe cases we can experience brain damage and death, possible long-term genetic effects from mutated DNA, and as well the big predictor of outcome is increased cancer rates. Now there are alpha, beta, and gamma particles associated with nuclear radionuclide emissions. An alpha particle is defined as a positively charged particle that is ejected spontaneously from the nuclei of some radioactive elements, and we'll talk about some of those here in terms of the ones of most concern in terms of environmental toxicology. Alpha particles, however, have a low penetrating power and a short range most of the time. In terms of dermal absorption, it really won't get past the dead layers of skin. One of the things that you have to be most concerned about with all radionuclides and even alpha particles is when you have ingested or inhaled an alpha particle and it becomes resident within the organism. And so then the damage that's happening is with active tissues, sometimes lung tissues, gut tissues, and if this in fact gets incorporated into a storage sequestration area like bone tissue for strontium 90, this is a potential long-term toxicant that will increase cancer rates. A beta particle is a charged particle emitted from a nucleus during radioactive decay. It actually has a mass. Its mass is equal to 1 over 1837 of that of a protein. It is negatively charged. When it is negatively charged, it is identical to an electron, and a positively charged beta particle is called a proton. Beta particles, beta radiation, are of great concern. These are the big boys, if you will. They can be cause skin burns if harmful, and again, if they enter the body. Beta particles are not particularly energetic typically, and they can be stopped by thin sheets of metal or plastic. Sometimes you will be working in some laboratory operations with radio-labeled chemicals as a way to look at metabolism or look at particular chemical processes. These are typically alpha or beta particles. You don't do gamma ray emitters in laboratory operations. Gamma rays are extraordinarily high energy, short wavelength. These are electromagnetic radiation, so these are packets of energy from the nucleus. These are the greatest concern in terms of the ability of a radionuclide to have a dramatic impact on the survivability of the organism. We frequently have gamma radiation accompanying the emission of alpha or beta particles. It always accompanies fission. Gamma rays are the penetrating kind of rays, and so these are the ones that you need lead bricks, many feet of concrete. These are the types of rays that most people associate with nuclear activities like power plants, and weapons materials that need to be shielded because of their high degree of lethality. They need to be shielded with dense materials such as lead or uranium. Gamma rays are higher energy packets of energy, similar in that regard to X-rays. One of the ways that we can talk about radionuclides is to refer to them by their half-life. This gives us an idea of how long they're going to be a problem. For example, in nuclear medicine, we typically use radionuclides for imaging purposes, diagnostic purposes, or therapy purposes that have relatively short half-lives on the order of hours to a few days. Half-life is defined as the time at which one half of the atoms of a particular radioactive substance disintegrates into another nuclear form. And so these half-lives can be from the millionths of a second to billions of years. And our major concerns in terms of hazardous waste management associated with radionuclides have to do with half-lives that are well over a dozen years. This is a photograph of Madame Curie, who helped to discover radioactivity and had a unit of radioactivity named after her. One Curie is equal to about 3.7 times 10 to the 10th disintegrations per second. This is a common unit of radioactivity. It's been replaced in the SI system by becquerels, and becquerels have the relationship where one Curie is equal to 37 gigabecquerels. And so you will hear both terms in common use. Curie is a little bit of a holdover, and becquerel is a more modern term. We can also define radioactive decay, and this is the decrease in the amount of any radioactive material with the passage of time, and this is due to the spontaneous natural emission from the atomic nuclei of either alpha or beta particles, and again, we often see this occurring with the release of an energy burst as gamma radiation. Now in the U.S. we have regulatory structures in terms of managing nuclear materials, radionuclides. The standards are issued by the Environmental Protection Agency under the Atomic Energy Act of 1954. And this legislation, this body of law, allows the U.S. EPA to impose limits on radiation exposures and levels. This has to do, for example, with occupational exposures as well. It also manages concentrations and quantities of radioactive material. Radioactive materials such as the material that we use in many smoke detectors, americium. As well with this body of law, legislate to the various types of authorities and people that can possess various types of radionuclides in terms of licensing, manufacture, and distribution. Let's talk about a case study here. This predates many of the students in this course. This was something that I lived through. This is Three Mile Island. This accident began about 4 a.m. on the morning of March 28, 1979. This particular plant in the eastern United States experienced a failure in a secondary non-nuclear section of the main plant, and there was a coolant pump failure. And so it wasn't in the nuclear housing, but it was in the cooling operations for the nuclear reactor. The most disturbing thing from a personal basis about this was there happened to be a popular movie playing at the time that was very similar in terms of what might happen if a nuclear power plant had a meltdown. Because of this movie, the public was sensitized, or perhaps overly sensitized, to the risks of nuclear power, nuclear energy, especially in populated areas. And then pretty much within a matter of months to have what amounts to the most serious nuclear accident on U.S. soil happen was extraordinarily disturbing for many people. It was disturbing for me. I was in college or graduate school at this particular time. Many of us were watching our TV, watching our news for what might happen, having seen essentially in a movie portrayal what amounted to an almost worst case scenario. In this particular situation, this backup coolant valve was not reopened after a test 2 days earlier, and so human error was responsible for this. This gave some erroneous coolant water and level readings in the reactor. The reading was high, it was showing high, but it was actually low due to gas bubble voids because it was starting to get hot. And so the volume of the water, because of the bubbles, the gas bubbles that were forming in the boiling operation, there was an H2 gas buildup in the containment structure. H2 has a flash point when exposed to oxygen, meaning it's explosive. And so you have an explosive situation inside of the nuclear reactor. In this particular case, the top of the fuel rods did melt. This melting process, the idea of a nuclear meltdown, started to occur. The idea that once this achieves critical mass, this nuclear meltdown can essentially melt through the Earth's surface and keep going down, obviously beyond any sort of human containment structure. This image here has, from the AP feed, from the Times, stub ends of broken fuel assemblies adhering to the bottom of the Three Mile Island damaged Unit 2 reactor. Now, Three Mile Island was in Pennsylvania, and there were communities and towns nearby. This particular newspaper photograph from the AP, this was a scene at Goldsboro, Pennsylvania on March 31st, 1979, 3 days after the nuclear accident in Three Mile Island in Middletown, Pennsylvania. Most people in the area following the nuclear accident either evacuated or stayed indoors. In the background, at the center of one of the is one of the cooling towers, and you can see that right down here, one of the cooling towers of the nuclear facility. March 28, 1999 was the 20th anniversary of the nation's largest nuclear accident. So we've gone past 25 years as of today. Another picture here shows the cooling towers and the cooling stacks for the Unit 2 reactor in the foreground. This is the one that had the nuclear accident, or dormant, and again, this is in celebration or recognition of the 20th anniversary of this accident. There was a partial meltdown. Only the reactor and cooling stacks at Unit 1 have continued to produce power, and so this Three Mile Island operation is still happening. The shutdown of the Unit 2 continues to this day. Now, it was of interest with the public health authorities to go into this situation and examine the public health and environmental impacts in terms of this near meltdown. There were thousands of environmental samples of various media such as air, water, and milk, vegetation, soil, and foodstuffs that were collected looking for potential radionuclides from the releases happening during this incident. The observation in terms of scientific analysis of this is that there were very low levels of radionuclides in this these samples that could be attributed to releases from the accident. Various comprehensive investigations and assessments by several organizations concluded that in spite of the damage to the reactor, most of the radiation was contained, and the actual release had very negligible effects on the physical health of the individuals or the environment. The calculated average dose to the community members around this incident was less than that of an X-ray and much, much less than background. So although this was a serious incident and it did go through the initial stages of a meltdown, it was caught in time prior to any sort of explosive release of radioactive material. What happened in this particular case was a release of gas pressure and some radioactive gases, not necessarily radioactive solids. When the epidemiologists went back and looked at the 20-year cancer epidemiology, the overall number of deaths from cancer, and this is what we look at in terms of one of the indicators of exposure to radioactive materials, but they found that the overall number of deaths from cancer was not significantly different from the general population within a 5-mile radius of the incident. So this is some good news. There was, however, a small rise in the number of lymphatic and blood cancer deaths among women in the exposed youth the exposed group. And so whether or not this was a statistical blip or a real cause effect, there was an observation in terms of positive relationship in the exposed cohort to increased risk of cancer of the lymphatic and blood systems in women. Another incident that's in our environmental history is that of Chernobyl. Chernobyl was the largest nuclear accident on the planet. Give you again the AP feed here, and you can see in this particular photograph the reactor in this whole center area has exploded out. This is a pretty significant damaged reactor. You can read about Chernobyl and some of the incidents. The follow-up analysis is still occurring to this day. The aerial view of the Chernobyl nuclear power reactor in Chernobyl, Ukraine shows damage from an explosion and fire on April 26, 1986. The blast killed 31 people and sent large amounts of dangerous radioactive material into the atmosphere. The contamination was carried across Western Europe by the wind to Sweden, Finland, and northern part of Britain, France, and Italy. The ghosts of history's worst nuclear reactor accident lurked everywhere in the surrounding countryside for more than 10 years later, as more than 40,000 people were diagnosed with cancer. And so here's a situation where there was a tremendous environmental release of radionuclides and impact to not only the human population, but to many species of wildlife. Environmental impacts were significant in this particular image. A Ukrainian Academy of Sciences member shows a four-legged chick, obviously a mutation in his laboratory. He's been studying the biological mutations in area wildlife since April 86, and he's found dozens of new bacteria and viruses and new forms of plant and animal diseases following this particular catastrophe. The cause-effect in these kind of follow-up investigations is always difficult, but you can do some epidemiological background analysis of unimpacted zones and come up with reasonably conclusive cause-effect. In Chernobyl, it was dramatic because, in fact, in this particular case, the nuclear processes produced an explosive situation. It wasn't a nuclear explosion, but because the containment was broken, a large amount of material was actually released into the atmosphere. So there was a plume and a deposition. There was tremendous concern about that plume. It was tracked atmospherically. There was potential concern for the quality of dairy products, primarily from the incorporation of strontium 90, which behaves chemically very much like calcium, and the incorporation of that into dairy products, for example, in Finland. This 1986 aerial view of the reactor for Chernobyl shows the damage from the explosion and fire that sent this amount of radioactive material. The plant in 1999 was still running because of the particular energy problems in the Ukraine. You can see that the sarcophagus, as they call it, that they built around the damaged area, there's not much you can do when you have a radioactive site like this other than box it up, and in fact that's what was done. This particular site, in terms of the initial follow-up, was characterized by some tremendous heroics by individual workers and community members in terms of mitigating, or the early responders. Many of those people subsequently died not only from radiation sickness, but from the cancers from the high intense radioactivity associated with this damaged site. In the U.S., because of our nuclear weapons processes and creation in the 1950s and some of the tests in the 1960s as well, we have, in terms of our major challenge, a major mixed waste challenge from these manufacturing operations. This continues to this day and will be with us for decades to come. This mixed waste combines radioactive material, and this can be low-level, high-level, or transuranic, TRU-type waste. It combines these radioactive wastes with hazardous wastes, and these hazardous wastes can be typical sort of solvents, again, and heavy metals. The scale of the contamination problem is significant. There are 4,000 DOE contaminated sites and about 7,000 DOD contaminated sites. And these, again, are mixed waste sites. The hazardous waste, in terms of a typical profile, includes solvents like TCE, tetrachloroethylene, chromium, lead, or PHCs, petroleum hydrocarbons. And so typically we now have, in terms of managing the waste, we not only have concern, for example, of how to degrade a solvent, how to remove a solvent, but we also have to manage the radionuclides in there. And so the risk management becomes extraordinarily complex. The radioactive wastes of highest concern in terms of the U.S. Mixed Waste Challenge include tritium, 14 carbon, 99 technetium, iodine-131 and 129, radioactive xenon, cesium-137, uranium-238, plutonium from nuclear weapons production, and americium-241. Americium is also used in our smoke detectors in our houses. Now, tritium, or 3-hydrogen as it's called, has a half-life of 12.3 years. We use it occasionally in laboratory experiments for labeling. It's a beta emitter. It emits with an energy of 0.019 mega electron volts, or MeVs. This is a relatively weak energy in terms of other nuclear emissions. Because it's hydrogen, it's highly mobile. It commingles with hydrogen in the natural environment spontaneously. 99% of what has been released appears as tritiated water, and so that's HTO. It is a product of cosmic radiation, so there is a natural background of tritium. It's a process byproduct from weapons production and reactors. You may have heard of heavy water before. Tritiated water is heavy water. In terms of natural sources, in the natural background, there's about 30 megacuries, and we have contributed to that in terms of some of our 1960s weapons tests, in terms of it enhancing the natural background by an overall number of 4,500 megacuries. It's not considered a major toxicological hazard. It does have some problems in groundwater around nuclear impacted sites. Carbon-14 has a half-life of over 5,000 years. It's a beta emitter at about 0.156, so it's a little bit higher energy than tritium. It's involved with carbon chemistry. It's used in laboratory processes quite often. It's virtually inseparable from carbon-12. It's sufficiently low concentration. It's actually considered exempted from treatment as a nuclear waste. There's no known physical or chemical process that can concentrate this particular radioisotope. It's a normal part of background radiation. It comes to us from cosmic radiation impacting on carbon molecules, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and being incorporated into biological systems. There's about 300 megacuries in the natural background from natural sources, and we find it in the environment in carbonate and carbon dioxide systems. Technetium-99, its half-life is actually goes through a its transition through a two-step decay. Its first transition is a six-hour half-life to a metastable state of 99, and then a 20,000-year half-life for 99. It's a gamma emitter and a beta emitter. It has a gamma emission of 0.142, so pretty potent, mega electron volts, and a beta emission of 0.293. Decays comes to us from U-235 emission, molybdenum-98 decay, and technetium-99. And we find it in the natural environment as technetium plus 7 oxidation state, the protectinate anion, oxyanion, TCO4 minus. You can imagine this has some potential to be mobile or to dissolve in waters. As when it's oxidized as TCO4, it is soluble. It's slightly sorbed to minerals. It's one of the most, it's TCO2 is the most common form in natural groundwater, typically available in trace concentrations under nuclear impacted zones at 10 to the minus ninth molar concentrations. Of particular interest is iodine 129 and 131. Its half-life is 100 million years. 10 million years. 1.6 times 10 to the minus 7th years for 129. 131 is a half-life of 8.404 days. Iodine 131 has some medical applications in terms of imaging. It's used for thyroid analysis. It is a beta emitter of 0.15 mega electron volts, a gamma emitter, and it does have a beta emission and a gamma emission of 0.3 mega electron volts for 131, and so it can actually be used to destroy tissue. We find we produce iodine 131 from uranium fission. As it turns out, it can be oxidized to iodate in solution. It's predominantly found in the environment as iodate solution. Xenon-133 is a common gas associated with gas phase nuclear releases. Its half-life is 5.2 days, so it's got a relatively short half-life. It is a beta emitter. It's 0.606 mega electron volts, and so it packs a pretty good punch. It's gamma at 0.081 mega electron volts. Since it's a noble gas, it's inert and therefore is limited in terms of its chemical reactivity. It can be solubilized in plastics and polymers, and so containing xenon-133 is difficult. It's not concentrated in living systems, and so the risk analysis from radioactive xenon is less than some of the other players. Cesium-137 is a problem. Its half-life is 30.17 years. We find cesium-137 in medical diagnostic uses, for instance, gamma ray imaging devices. It has a beta energy of 0.512 and a gamma energy of 0.662. And so this combination is going to yield a situation where cesium-137 has to be highly shielded. This is going to be lead contained. This is going to be contained by yards worth of cement in any sort of diagnostic application. Cesium-137, for example, can be used to image pipes in industrial operations. It's a group 1 alkali metal, so it's highly soluble. It's stable in an aqueous environmental form, so once released, there's its problems in terms of incorporating into the natural environment. It's a very devilishly hard radionuclide to clean up because of its incorporation into the soil structures, into components such as concrete or asphalt. It's associated with many, many mineral substrates in contaminated areas. Uranium-238 has a half-life of 4 times 10 to the minus 9th years, and so it's going to be around for a very, very long time, forever in terms of the human time scale. It's an alpha emitter at 4.2 mega electron volts, so it packs a pretty good punch. Its valence states include 0 all the way up to a valence state of 4. It occurs in nature as various oxide forms, soluble oxide forms and insoluble oxide forms. Quite often we find uranyl complexes, and these can be such as carbonates in the local groundwater environments. The retardation that is observed for various uranyl and uranium oxide contaminants vary on a case-by-case basis with the mineral substrates. We have a problem with uranium in groundwater and in soil from underground nuclear testing that happened during the 50s and the 60s. Plutonium-239 is the major radionuclide used in nuclear weapons. It has a half-life of over 20,000 years. It's an alpha emitter and others. It does have a fairly complex decay process. In terms of environmental contamination, we can have oxidation states from 2 to 6 to 7 that exist. All of them, or mostly all of them, can exist in water. The environmental chemistry of plutonium is somewhat similar to uranium. It can exist as a colloidal and stable hydroxide in solution. It does sorb to rocks, and this is a good thing in terms of groundwater migration, but sometimes complexing organic ligands can actually promote dissolution and migration in the subsurface. 241 americium is of interest because it is found in many households. It is a fairly high energy alpha emitter and gamma emitter. It's a common alpha radiation source. We use it in smoke detectors because small amounts of americium can ionize smoke particles. These ionized smoke particles then can trigger off an electrostatic detector and a smoke alarm. It's in terms of the environment, it forms some stable oxides. It's stable in solution. It can be strongly sorbed by common rocks and ambient pH. And it can actually also, like plutonium, be complexed by various types of ligands. Then this will increase its solubility and potential migration in the subsurface. In the U.S., we've got, as you can imagine, a significant mixed waste challenge just in terms of the number, but also the diversity of these contaminated sites. The challenge in terms of the United States of managing this contamination, we try to adopt the TMV approach to just generalized hazardous waste management, and that's a reduction in the toxicity, the mobility, or the volume of the waste. Now, remember that these are elemental wastes, even though they're radioactive elements, and so we can never completely destroy them, and so quite often what we try to do is manage them by boxing it, bag it, barrel it, and store it. Now, the mixed waste has to do with the fact that these are mixtures of organic and inorganic hazardous wastes in addition to the radionuclides. Some of these approaches can be limited by the various chemistry of the metals. We sometimes have to deal in some of these contaminated soups with multiple oxidation states. You can get a sense that these challenges are extraordinarily complex. Hazardous waste in and of itself is a complex undertaking in terms of environmental engineering. When you add the radionuclides, radioactive materials, it becomes exponentially more difficult to manage. In terms of the U.S. strategy, there's a relative risk consideration. The worst players in terms of a triage are managed separately from the lower level wastes. And so examining the half-life, the energy, and the mobility in terms of segregating the tasks, the various receptor sites, and some of the costs. Obviously, for the transuranics, the higher energy wastes, they're going to be extraordinarily expensive. Some of these facilities, such as the Hanford facility, have operation budgets in excess of $1 billion per year targeted towards environmental management. One of the strategies in mixed waste management is to separate the radionuclide, the radioactive waste, from the hazardous material. Take a look at separating as well the organic from the inorganic. And so typical hazardous waste management approaches like adsorption onto carbon, incineration in some cases, pyrolysis, various sorts of treatments can be used for the traditional hazardous waste. But typically the approach that works best in mixed waste is a volume reduction because inevitably we are going to be storing this material because, again, we can't destroy it. So we want to be able to store the smallest volume because the containers, the sites, the landmass required for storage is pretty significant. One of the approaches to reducing the volume of mixed waste is called vitrification. Vitrification, as you'll see in the little video that we'll show here, is a way to glassify or encase in glass some of these heavy-duty radionuclides These glass have long-term geological stability that you can't leach out of a glass, and so this gives at least hazardous waste managers a little bit of hope for the immediate storage and disposition of these mixed wastes. There are, however, some very big how-to questions. This is an active area of research and engineering. Many of the technologies that are being used, and you'll hear this in the video as well, are fairly experimental. We're going down pathways in terms of hazardous waste management, mixed waste management, we've never had to deal with before. Many of this is due to the expediency. Back in World War II of the development, there wasn't a lot of care, concern, or perhaps even knowledge of environmental impacts, environmental contamination. There was a clear and present danger in terms of World War II and managing all of the military concerns associated with developing nuclear arms and nuclear weapons. We now have this legacy. In a certain sense, we won the battle and we won the war, but we are still to this day managing the weapons and the tools of those victories. In terms of the Department of Energy, the focus areas of where they've put their resources, and that's in contaminant and plume containment and remediation, limiting mobility, toxicity, mobility, and volume is a major hazardous waste management direction. Identifying the distribution, concentration, where the plume is going, if it's in the subsurface. Again, we buried a lot of our problems historically. They are coming back to haunt us. One of the primary approaches is to do containment and in situ treatment, to treat it where it lies. And so even if it's in the subsurface, can we artificially create a barrier in the subsurface to contain it? Even if it's a couple hundred feet down, the idea of digging it out is pretty unrealistic. And so can we inject materials to form an artificial barrier to keep, for instance, a contaminated plume from impacting groundwater? There's been a lot of effort on mixed waste characterization, research into treatment and disposal. There is a lot of effort in low-level waste and how to manage low-level waste, even low-level waste that comes out of university research laboratories. We do have some lack of accepted treatment and disposal capacity for many types of mixed waste. There are some focus areas in the Department of Energy. High-level waste tank remediation is a big problem. Quite often there were these below-ground storage tanks that were used to store slurries and liquid waste. Unfortunately, many of these tanks were single-walled. The steel that was in these tanks has deteriorated because of the radionuclide reactive chemistry. Excuse me. Another area is landfill stabilization, examination of the migration and plotting and modeling where a plume is going and when it might impact a natural resource such as a river. Strategies about, again, in situ containment and treatment. There is some significant amount of work on decontaminating and decommissioning some of these facilities, getting rid of the buildings. We'll talk about several of those here today in the video, but also in some other case studies. And then treatment considerations of developing the specific new treatment chemistries associated with hazardous waste remediation. One of the biggest challenges that we have in the Pacific Northwest, one of the largest DOE sites in the United States, is the Hanford, Washington site. This is a World War II photo of the Hanford Desert Operations. This is the B reactor. It was the world's first plutonium production reactor. When you do nuclear processes, as you probably understand, you need tremendous amounts of water for cooling processes. You can see here in the background of this plant, this is the Columbia River, a major aquatic ecosystem for the Pacific Northwest. Operations that contaminated the groundwater and the soils beneath active operations in Hanford have the ability to plume and follow the hydraulic gradient and down to the river. Then it is highly mobile in terms of impacting many of the communities downriver on this fairly large river and system. The Columbia River in this particular photo, this is a modern AP wire photo. This is the closed F reactor that has on the Hanford Nuclear Reservation. This is near Richland, Washington. Finally, here today, what we're going to do is a short 10-minute video. It's a case presentation. This is a DOE production. This isn't an environmental activist group. This isn't taking a position other than the fact that this is going to cost the U.S. taxpayers billions of dollars in the future part of our treatment of these mixed wastes.
The desert of southeastern Washington is home to what may be the most contaminated area in the United States. For more than 40 years, the U.S. government produced plutonium for nuclear weapons at the Hanford site. Now, with the Cold War behind us, the focus at Hanford is on cleaning up the enormous amounts of radioactive and chemically hazardous wastes produced while making plutonium. Hanford was home to America's first plutonium production facilities. Production began in 1944 as part of the Manhattan Project, a World War II effort to build an atomic bomb. Plutonium from Hanford was used in the bomb dropped on Nagasaki, Japan in August of 1945. For the next 45 years, Hanford's primary mission was to produce plutonium for use in nuclear weapons. During that time, Hanford went through several major expansions. Eventually, the government built 9 nuclear production reactors, 5 chemical separation plants, and dozens of support facilities. Plutonium production ended at Hanford in 1990. The U.S. Department of Energy manages the 560-square-mile Hanford site. Site workers are now engaged in one of the world's largest environmental cleanup projects. More than 1,500 waste sites have been identified at Hanford, ranging from small areas of surface contamination to 177 underground storage tanks that hold about 54 million gallons of highly radioactive and chemically hazardous waste. Some of Hanford's waste will remain dangerous for thousands of years. It must be kept away from people and the environment during that time. There is urgency to the cleanup. In many cases, the longer we delay, the more hazardous and expensive the problem becomes. Many storage facilities have exceeded their design life and are deteriorating, making it much more difficult to safely store the waste. Some of the waste poses a significant threat to workers, the public, and the environment. An accident or further spread of the contamination would also put the region's economy at risk. Much of the Hanford site is free of contamination. Large areas of the site were used as safety and security buffers. However, the central portion of the site, which consists of areas called 200 East and 200 West, has substantial problems. The 200 areas contain the underground storage tanks, the chemical processing plants, and other plutonium facilities. Spent fuel stored at 2 of the shutdown reactors along the Columbia River and laboratories, research facilities, and burial grounds at the south end of the site also pose significant cleanup challenges. The waste in Hanford's underground tanks presents one of the most urgent, complex, and costly challenges. 149 of the 177 tanks have just a single wall of carbon steel encased in concrete for containment. These tanks, which range in size from 55,000 to 1 million gallons, were never intended for long-term storage. The oldest of these tanks date back to the 1940s. Nearly 70 have leaked more than a million gallons of high-level radioactive waste to the ground. Some of this waste has reached the groundwater. The remaining 28 tanks have a double shell of steel, and none are believed to have leaked. These tanks, however, cannot be used indefinitely. In time, the double shell tanks will also fail. Site workers have pumped much of the liquid out of the single shell tanks into the double shell tanks. When the liquids are removed, a semi-solid sludge-like material remains behind. Retrieving this sludge is itself a serious challenge, as some methods may result in more waste leaked to the soil. Plans are to separate the tank waste, including the sludge, into separate high and low activity waste streams. These wastes will then be vitrified, a process that mixes the radioactive waste with molten glass. The mixture is poured into stainless steel containers, where it will harden into a solid glass form. The majority of Hanford's vitrified waste will be low activity and will be buried on site. The canisters of highly radioactive waste will be stored indefinitely at Hanford until a national geologic repository becomes available. These wastes will still be radioactive, but they will no longer be mobile. As long as waste remains in these aging tanks, it poses a severe threat to the Columbia River. The U.S. Department of Energy is working with a private contractor to begin construction of the vitrification facilities. However, these facilities are not scheduled to be fully operational until December 2009. Under the current schedule, vitrifying the first 10% of Hanford's tank waste won't be complete until the year 2018. The remaining waste may not be completely vitrified for another 30 years. Leaks from the tanks, along with billions of gallons of radioactive and hazardous liquid waste that was disposed into the soil at Hanford, have contaminated more than 200 square miles of groundwater beneath the site. Efforts are underway to intercept and treat some of these waste plumes before they reach the Columbia River. Pumping the groundwater and treating it to remove some of the radioactive and chemical contaminants has met with some success. Another major problem at Hanford is more than 2,000 tons of spent nuclear fuel stored in two water-filled basins just a quarter mile from the Columbia River. The bottom of these basins are covered with as much as 2 to 3 feet of highly radioactive sludge. Much of the fuel is badly corroded. At least one of the basins has leaked in the past. Plans to move the fuel into storage containers away from the river are moving forward, but have suffered repeated setbacks and cost escalations. Removal of the spent fuel and sludge from the basins is scheduled to be complete in the next decade. Hanford's plutonium finishing plant also poses major technical and cost challenges. The facility contains several tons of plutonium in a variety of forms. Some of this plutonium must go through a stabilization process to allow safe long-term storage. Despite the threats posed by the deteriorating condition of this facility, other more urgent problems at Hanford have taken priority. The cost of the Hanford cleanup and the availability of sufficient funding is an ongoing concern. Cleanup will take decades and cost tens of billions of dollars. Construction of the tank waste treatment facilities will require an increase of more than $500 million each year to Hanford's cleanup budget, which typically has exceeded $1 billion a year. Congress has yet to demonstrate a willingness to commit to this level of spending for the 20 to 30 years or more that it will take to construct and operate the tank waste treatment facilities. Hanford is just one of about a dozen major sites around the country, and more than 75 overall, that were involved in producing materials for America's nuclear weapons program. Although Hanford has the most extensive contamination and waste problems, other sites have their own unique cleanup challenges. Hanford cleanup is governed by an agreement between the U.S. Department of Energy, the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, and the state of Washington. This cleanup plan, called the Tri-Party Agreement, was initially signed in 1989. The Tri-Party Agreement sets timetables for accomplishing the cleanup activities and covers about 30 years of work. Considerable progress has been made in some areas since cleanup began at Hanford in 1989. However, until the waste is removed from the tanks and solidified, the plutonium is stabilized, the spent fuel is moved away from the river, and other major cleanup projects are completed, Hanford's waste remains a serious threat to the Northwest and its residents.
Well, there you have a good visual introduction to the mixed waste challenge in the United States. Next time, what we'll do is we'll transition from perhaps the inorganic side of environmental chemicals and the case studies that we've talked about to some organic chemicals. Specifically, next time, we'll talk about pentachlorophenol and PCBs. Until that time, we'll see you. Thanks so much.